Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 13th of April 1924, Mussolini, Mail and Motors, Vauxhall Motors. Not in this episode, for reasons of time, ignorance or sloth. A correspondent has written to complain about the amount of litter on London streets. Some professors have been tried, convicted and sentenced to death in Kiev for believing in such things as free speech. The Soviets have been abusing Ramsay MacDonald, the Labour Prime Minister. There was an article suggesting that Richard Cobden may not have been the free trader we, who have heard of him, tend to think he was. And the Underground have put up some art in Westminster Station. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. A committee of experts, known as the Dawes Committee, has issued its report on what is to be done about reparations. Their conclusions are that Germany can pay some reparations, and that for that to happen, the Ruhr, currently under French occupation, must be returned. Mussolini's fascists have triumphed in the Italian elections. More on that later. Hugo Stinnes, the German industrialist who was busy buying up, well, pretty much everything during the German hyperinflation last year, see the 9th of September 1923 episode, and has gone very quietly recently, has died. In Madrid, they have decided to stop driving on the left and start driving on the right. Now, I hate to issue spoilers, but I would be derelict in my duty if I failed to point out that Spain will be plunged into a civil war in a few years' time. The government has been defeated in the House of Commons on the issue of an evictions bill. Also in Parliament, a fight broke out in the Commons after two Labour members, including one John Maxton, who I thought I'd mentioned in a previous episode but hadn't, he's a Labour firebrand, confronted Leo Amery, Conservative former First Lord of the Admiralty. This is not the first time there have been fisticuffs in the House of Commons. See the 15th of April 1923 episode. Also in Parliament, MPs have voted to give themselves free rail passes between London and their constituencies. MPs being paid and being able to claim expenses is standard practice nowadays, and indeed led to a scandal a decade or so ago. But that wasn't always the case. MPs weren't paid at all until 1910. Before then, they were expected to be independently wealthy. I am far from sure that payment by the state has improved the quality of our elected representatives. In the 15th of July 1923 episode, I mentioned that the British had yet to resolve whether to spell tyre, as in the thing that goes on a wheel, with an I or a Y. A Dunlop ad in this week's paper would suggest that Y is winning out. Ridiculous, but there you go. There's been an arrest in the Borden murder case I mentioned last week. It's a soldier from the nearby barracks, called Goldenberg. It would just have to be. There's been a correspondence on the subject of execution holidays. What is an execution holiday, I hear you ask? Well, once upon a time, before 1868, executions were held in public, and children would often be given the morning off school, a holiday, in order to watch them. Well, it's cheaper than centre parks. In the 2nd of March episode, I mentioned the case of a man who had been committed to a lunatic asylum and had successfully sued the doctors who committed him. Those doctors are, not surprisingly, appealing the verdict. Who is playing Gratiano in the old Vix production of The Merchant of Venice, I hear you ask? Well, I can tell you. It's John Lorry. Private Fraser? Out of Dad's Army? The long-running sitcom? Oh, never mind. I saw this in Tuesday's edition. In this country, the only reptile habitually used as food is the green turtle of the tropical seas, a luxury almost part of the ritual of ceremonial banquets. And here's another little sign of the times from a speech by Neville Chamberlain. "I do not think," Mr. Chamberlain observed, "it needs a prophet to say that the Liberals are, in the future, doomed to extinction as a party." When Neville Chamberlain thinks you're doomed. I think it's worth taking some time to think about this. The Liberal Party and its predecessors, the Whigs, were enormously successful. Their ideas of low taxes and low regulation dominated British politics for two centuries and were crucial to establishing Britain as a republic in all but name and the foundation of the Industrial Revolution. You would have thought that with achievements like that under their belt, they would be unassailable. But socialism has been on the rise for the last 20 years. In response, the Liberal Party introduced state pensions, a state GP service, and a limited system for unemployment benefit before the war, not very liberal. This is chronicled by George Dangerfield in his book The Strange Death of Liberal England. Worse still, by the 1920s, few liberals were particularly liberal. Many had been seduced by the claims of socialism, and when the time came, had little difficulty in joining the Labour Party. In Thursday's edition, a Professor E.A. Gardner of Hampstead wrote, "While letters posted in the evening at a provincial centre such as Oxford or Bristol usually appear on the breakfast table in London, letters posted at the same time in London are often not delivered until the afternoon of the next day in Oxford or Bristol. It is thus impossible to make by post an appointment from London after about 4:30 in the afternoon." Nowadays, arranging your diary like this would be ridiculous. But this is before the internet, and at a time when not everyone was on the phone, and telegrams were expensive. In Thursday's edition, the Times reported on a speech made by Sir Doveton Sturdy, Admiral of the Fleet, and hero of the Battle of the Falklands of 1914. Talking about naval armament, he said, "As to weapons, all the indications were that the gun would continue to maintain its preeminence. Torpedoes, bombs, and mines would not succeed in usurping its position." Oh dear. It's not just the big gun battleships were on the cusp of being replaced by aircraft carriers, the aircraft carrying torpedoes and mines, but that warship guns have got a lot smaller over the years. It's not the only dodgy prediction in this week's Times. This is from Thursday. "Let us be thankful for small mercies. The London County Council are only going to take down Waterloo Bridge," see the 30th of March episode, "and rebuild it rather wider. We shall have the old number of arches, of the old height and span, but Waterloo Bridge will never be the same again, although its two river fronts will present to the eye the very same stones arranged in the very same way as now." The article expresses sadness at the widening. "We are looking for the last time on one of the most famous and most beautiful things in London, and thinks it knows the cause. The new blunder comes from the old cause, want of foresight and of plan." All I can say is, try living somewhere where the state does plan. Of course, they didn't even get to keep the stones. Opel is a well-known European car brand. But while you will find Opel cars in the United Kingdom, you won't find them labelled as such. In the UK, they are known as Vauxhalls. Both brands were part of GM, and now Stellantis. And GM decided to use the Vauxhall brand in the UK probably because some potential customers prefer to believe that Vauxhall was British when it wasn't. However, from 1924's perspective, that is in the future. About a year in the future. For the time being, Vauxhall is an independent manufacturer. A not very successful independent manufacturer. This week they held their annual general meeting. The chairman says they've turned a corner. But then he talks about an overdraft. Usually big companies don't have overdrafts. They have preference shares or debentures. He also had this to say. "There is one other point which is of vital importance to us as shareholders, and is a matter in which you can render great service, not only to the company, but to all other manufacturers of British motor cars, in urging in every possible way that the government shall certainly maintain the duty on imported motor cars." Hear, hear. "Any modification of the duty at the present time, let alone the removal of this duty, would prove disastrous to every British factory." So in 1924 there are tariffs on cars. So much for free trade. And what of his claim that their removal would be disastrous? Well, in 1973, when the UK joined the then European Economic Community, they were removed. In 1975, the largest British manufacturer, British Leyland, went bust. So in that sense, he was right. On the other hand, it would appear that for 50 years, British consumers were forced to buy overpriced domestically built tat. Italy, that's Mussolini's Italy, has held a general election. This is from Tuesday the 8th. "It is certain that the fascisti, nationalists, have secured far more than the percentage of votes cast requisite to secure the election of their list under the new system, and will probably secure more than all the other lists put together." Sounds legit. But what is this new system of which they speak? It doesn't help that I have heard two distinct versions of this, but the gist of it is that the largest party gets two-thirds of the seats. Now, this might or might not have favoured the fascists, but the question is, how did they manage to get it through Parliament? Intimidation? The Wikipedia page on this suggests that that was a factor. But also, there were other factors at play. It would appear that Mussolini was quite the political manoeuvrer. There is very little doubt that abstentions, voluntary or forced, were the rule very largely in the South. That doesn't sound quite so legit. Curious provisions in the electoral law, such as that, for example, which renders null a vote marked with a pen or a copying ink pencil, have not been without their effect. I am not sure what a copying ink pencil is, but even so, nothing says democracy like the vote that could be changed at a later date. Things became clearer on Wednesday, with reports that the Fascisti had won 355 seats out of 535. Such figures, it is maintained, must remove the last objection against the new electoral law, since the majority in the House would have been the same even under the old system. 355 out of 535 is 66%. If this report is to be believed, the fascists have done very well. Signor Michele Bianchi, one of Mussolini's sidekicks, has congratulated Signor Mussolini by telegram on having received over 80% of the votes cast in the south of Italy. The elections in the south were not always held in that atmosphere of law and order which is reported from other parts of Italy. Oh. The Times published an editorial. The Italian general election held on Sunday has given a sweeping victory to the Fascisti, the party of the government and of Signor Mussolini. The result was anticipated. The new electoral law adopted by the defunct Parliament was so framed as to make such a victory certain, and the administrative methods now practiced in Italy would hardly admit of a government defeat. The new electoral law adopted by the defunct Parliament was so framed as to make such a victory certain. Was it? If it was a free and fair election, or even a freeish and fairish election, there was always the possibility that the fascists could have lost. The statement that the administrative methods now practiced in Italy would hardly admit of a government defeat is a bit more disturbing. I can only imagine the Times is referring to political violence. These elections are profoundly instructive. They represent a curious and novel compromise between democracy and dictatorship. It's kind of one or the other. The modern principles of democracy lie deep in the spirit of the modern world, yet in their general application in Italy they had been far from successful. A point was reached at which it was apparently impossible to secure stability and continuity of policy by purely democratic methods. Things are so much better today. Yet it is significant that, after all, Signor Mussolini should have found it necessary to confirm his conception of strong government by consulting the electorate under conditions which would not endanger continuity of policy, but would at the same time provide for the expression of various shades of public opinion in a new legislative assembly. Only on a temporary basis. The editorial then says this. The Italian experiment has reached a stage at which it should be considered with serious and sympathetic attention. There's a bloke holed up in a Bavarian prison who will be considering it very sympathetically. While in various countries of Europe, lip service is still rendered to democracy, oligarchic or dictatorial methods are being more and more extensively applied in practice. And it's going to get a whole load worse. The rumours that parties, who have here and there beaten the Fascisti, are being penalised, must provoke anxiety and regret. I should think so. There are two aspects to this. First, this election was fixed. The second, and more interesting, is the Times' reaction. Although it doesn't like what is happening in Italy, it is not in the mood for condemnation. I can't help but think that is because of the similarities between Italy and Great Britain. Italy is a constitutional monarchy like Britain. Italy is or was a democracy like Britain. Italy fought in the First World War like Britain. Italy suffered tremendously like Britain. Italy saw the rise of socialism, like Britain. Italy saw a wave of strikes, like Britain. Could Italy perhaps, in the mind of the Times editorialist, far from being something to avoid, be something to emulate? Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.